Welcome to the Commonwealth Matters. I'm Richard Nelson, your host. Kentucky is just one of a handful of states that has no meaningful education choice outside of public schools. Last year, the state Supreme Court struck down an important education choice bill, and we're told that we need to amend our Constitution in order to offer school choice in the Commonwealth. But can it be done? The Kentucky Education Association and public school teachers have had an outsized influence in state elections in recent years, and others are wondering if this can pass. Joining us to talk further is Greg Brock of Invest in Education, a group that's focused on advancing school choice at the federal level in a way that respects federalism, complements current school choice in the states that have it, and facilitates greater education opportunities across the country. Greg, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard. Appreciate it.
Greg, so before we jump into what you're working on at the federal level, why don't you tell us a little bit about, first of all, how did you get involved with the school choice movement? Which, by the way, I'm not even sure if that's the term that's being used. I think we're calling it education freedom. Is that correct? Is that the more accurate term?
Accurate, and also, I think, becoming more popular. Yes, education freedom. Educational choice and education freedom.
So education freedom, how did you get involved with that? And then tell us a little bit about Invest in Education.
Well, I've always believed very strongly in educational choice, going back to my own experience. I'm the personal experience. I'm the product of both public education as well as Catholic school. My parents raised a large family, sacrificed enormously to send all of their children to Catholic middle school and high school in response to a poorly performing public school, and also some of the curriculum issues that actually are even more prevalent today. They found the curriculum in the local public school to be something very objectionable to their faith. And so I took that in combination with a strong interest in politics in my 20s and 30s, getting involved in something that I really deeply care about, educational choice, empowering parents. And about 20 years ago, began working with former Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, at the state level in Michigan to try to expand educational choice. In fact, we did a ballot measure. We got clobbered at the ballot box 20 years ago, but that was a different era. But I worked with Secretary DeVos prior to her service in the cabinet around the country for about 15 years on the national level, working in states that did permit a pathway to educational choice.
That's great. So did you work with Secretary DeVos in the Department of Education while she was Education Secretary?
No, we worked. I worked with her continuing in the role that I had worked for her prior to her service in the cabinet. So I worked as the executive director of an organization called American Federation for Children, which she chaired and which had basically laid the groundwork for many of the proposals that she began to advance at the federal level. American Federation for Children, or AFC for short, which she chaired for many years. I worked at the state level in states like Florida, Ohio. There was a little bit of work in Kentucky going on at the time that she ended up moving on to the cabinet. But worked with her from outside the department to advocate for her education freedom agenda at the national level as well as in the various states.
Very good. Greg, tell us a little bit about Invest in Education.
Sure. Invest in Education Coalition actually started in the state of New York about 12 years ago with an effort to pass a tax credit scholarship to allow for publicly supported private school choice. As you can imagine, New York was a liberal state then, has become even more liberal since that time. And so the teachers union is extremely powerful in New York, much more powerful even than in a state like Kentucky, where I know they're very influential. And the teachers union opposed the effort there. There was a time where several Democratic leaders in the New York legislature were willing to consider a proposal. And so that's where Invest in Education Coalition began working 2011, 2012 to try to pass legislation there. And after about a 3 or 4 year effort, they came up short. They got it through one house of the legislature and couldn't get it through the other house. And so they abandoned the efforts there. But when President Trump was elected in 2016, Invest in Education, representing many families and coalition leaders for school choice in New York, said, maybe there's another route here. Maybe we can get something done at the federal level, which would essentially bypass the New York legislature, empower parents in New York and other large blue states like California, Michigan, and so forth, and many red states as well that didn't offer private school choice, and do it in a way that would be complementary to states like Florida, like Ohio and Indiana that did have robust school choice programs, and also making sure to respect, as you mentioned at the outset, the consistent principles that are consistent with limited government. And so during the Trump administration, because very few people, I think, in the educational choice movement, like in much of the country, anticipated a Trump victory, there was not adequate preparation at the time to take advantage of that opportunity. And so fast forward to today, where we're working to prepare for hopefully a new administration that would champion educational choice, and then we could get educational choice into all 50 states, including Kentucky. And so if your state does pass a constitutional amendment next year and then ultimately restores your education savings account program, the federal effort would complement that. If it does not, if Kentucky does not do that, the federal route would still give you, your parents, hope and opportunity to find alternatives to their local public schools.
Let's talk about that bill. It's called the Educational Choice for Children Act, the ECCA. And this is probably the top education freedom bill in Congress. And what it would do is it expands education freedom, like you say, in all 50 states. And this is through a federal tax credit scholarship. And it did receive a hearing not too long ago, didn't it, Greg? Tell us the status of the Education Choice for Children Act.
Yes, indeed. It did receive a hearing before the House Ways and Means Committee. And it's also assigned to the House Education and Workforce Committee on the House side. And it's assigned to the Senate Finance Committee on the Senate side. But the House Ways and Means Committee did hear testimony from several witnesses advocating for the bill. One is a highly successful scholarship tax credit graduate from Florida's state level program there, who's now working full time in the education freedom movement. And another witness was a parent from Pennsylvania who talked about her personal experience with her family in needing alternatives and pursuing private school choice. So it was a very informative hearing and a sign that the bill is viable and growing in momentum. The Educational Choice for Children Act, or ECCA, as you mentioned for short, the ECCA has 30 co-sponsors in the U.S. Senate. The leading sponsors are Senator Bill Cassidy of Louisiana and then Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina, who many people know because of his national profile. And then on the House side, the leading sponsors are Congressman Adrian Smith, who is on the House Ways and Means Committee. He's from Nebraska. And also Congressman Burgess Owens, who is from Utah. And so there's really a diverse coalition of supporters within Congress, at least among the spectrum within the Republican Party. And we've now got, with those numbers, over 60% of both the House Republican Caucus in Congress and the Senate Republican Caucus fully on board, committed as public co-sponsors of the legislation. So we've come a long way just in this past year.
Do you think it has a chance of passing next year?
I do think it has a chance of passing in the House. And to be candid and realistic, it doesn't have a chance of getting taken up in the Senate, because Senator Schumer, the majority leader, has always been philosophically opposed to educational choice. In fact, many of the Democratic Party leadership in Congress have not only made life very difficult for those advocating for private school choice, they even have tried to crack down on charter schools as well. And so they're really, the leadership in the Democratic Party is really about trying to limit choices, at least at the national level. I mean, it's ironic that they would take such a strong stand in opposition, because our polling shows almost as much support. In fact, about two-thirds of Democratic voters around the country support our legislation and support educational choice, in addition to about 70% of Republicans and about 70% of independents. But the key there is, in terms of the explanation for the Democratic opposition in Congress, is the immense power of the national teachers' unions in terms of the ground troops they put into elections and the vast resources, the tens of millions of dollars. They are basically the largest financial contributor to the Democratic Party congressional leadership. But this is an example where even the current occupant of the White House, himself a private school graduate and a private school parent, opposes school choice chiefly because of the influence of the national teachers' unions politically.
Greg, isn't this inconsistent with some basic democratic principles, or principles of the Democratic Party, I should say? They'd say they argue for personal freedom. They are, part of their platform is abortion rights, and they say that it's a woman's right, it's a woman's issue. They argue for decriminalizing illicit drugs. It's a personal freedom issue. Gender dysphoria, they would argue that it's an individual's choice. to determine their own gender and to pursue hormone therapy or transition surgeries. Yet, when it comes to parents having the freedom to choose where their child or children go to school, leading Democrats are opposed to this. And I don't want to oversimplify it, but this is my observation. What I'm seeing is what I'm saying. Is anybody bringing this to their attention, to Chuck Schumer's attention and to other Democrats' attention, that, hey, this is inconsistent with your position on other big issues?
Sure. It's not only inconsistent with their positions on other public policy issues, it's inconsistent with what many of them have practiced in their own families. Some of the leading opponents to educational choice are people who attended private school themselves and sent their own children to private school. And no one is arguing that they should not have that choice, but every parent should have that choice, especially those who lack the resources. Now, of course, members of Congress and highly influential political leaders, they typically have the resources. They're paid generous salaries by the taxpayers. They have the resources to send their own children to private school, and no one's arguing to take that away from them, but especially low-income parents, parents in working-class families, middle-class families, they ought to have the right to take their education business, education as a customer of the education system, to a different school if the school that they've been assigned in their neighborhood by the government is simply not meeting their children's needs, or not respecting their family's faith and values, or simply not safe. And so it is completely inconsistent. And that's why when people ask, well, what's the motivation for Democratic leadership opposition to school choice, if they have the inconsistency that you pointed out, and also if many of their voters support school choice, it comes down to the money and power and influence of the teachers' unions and the status quo education bureaucracy.
Greg, I want to talk about some of those specific objections that I heard recently at a public forum on education freedom. But before I go into that, I want to unpack in a little more detail what the ECCA is, the Educational Choice for Children Act, which is said it's essentially it's a scholarship fund. Tell us how it's funded and how those funds would be distributed if this is enacted in law.
Sure. So the Educational Choice for Children Act, at its heart, is really a tax bill. It's amending the federal tax code to incentivize individuals and corporations as taxpayers to contribute to state-level scholarship-granting organizations, also known as SGOs for short. And so these state-level scholarship-granting organizations would acquire these contributions from individual and corporate donors, and then in response to that, the individuals and corporations who contribute would receive a federal tax credit against their liability, federal tax liability. And so the state-level scholarship granting organizations are the ones who would award the scholarship based on family eligibility. So it's a $10 billion proposal. It would create private school choice opportunities and educational choice opportunities more broadly, because it includes not only private school tuition, but other eligible uses such as supplemental services, tutoring. There's even access for homeschooling families in this bill. It's a great opportunity. And the key is, it's not a new federal program. It's not new federal spending. These are private dollars, individuals and corporations contributing these dollars. It's simply incentivizing those private contributions for a public purpose, empowering parents with more choices. The eligibility for the family eligibility, it's based on income, and it's at 300% of the federal median family income standard. Now, I know that most folks probably aren't familiar with the various bureaucratic standards, but it differs, it varies from market to market. Basically, it's adjusted for the cost of living. So in Kentucky, we estimate that between 85 to 90% of your state's families with school-age children would be eligible under this opportunity. And again, I emphasize opportunity, not a program, because it's not the growth, it's not growing federal government in any way, it's not creating new education policy. It's tax policy with the objective of empowering parents to access more educational choices. So when we talk about the ECCA in terms of the policy, it's also important to point out that the strategy is one that involves a multi-year effort. As I mentioned previously, we do have hopes that we can pass this in the House next year. I think we're without hope in the Senate next year unless something really, really unusual happens. But the Senate, as you know, is nearly tied in terms of the party composition, and party control could very well shift to Republicans after the 2024 election. And obviously, the presidential elections can be very competitive. If the political winds blow the right way end of next year, we could be in the driver's seat to pass this in the first half of 2025 through the House, the Senate, and also have hopefully a champion in the White House who would sign the legislation and expend some political capital in Congress to get it done, make it a governing priority. Because in the past, a lot of Republicans have talked a big game about school choice at the national level, but they've never really done anything meaningful on it. And this is the opportunity to do something really meaningful, to be transformative in the lives of a lot of parents and families and children around the country, and give access to choice in all 50 states.
If you are enjoying this podcast, then please go to your favorite podcast platform and rate us. This is one of the ways that you can help our podcast audience grow. Also, please tell a friend about us. You can share the Commonwealth Matters on your social media platforms as well. Thanks again for listening to the Commonwealth Matters.
Very good. If you're just tuning in, I'm Richard Nelson talking about education freedom and the Education Choice for Children Act with Greg Brock of Invest in Education. Greg, you explained the ECCA as a federal change in tax policy. You said it's not going to cost taxpayers anything, but it really incentivizes individuals, corporations from contributing to a fund. And that fund would grant scholarships to needy kids or needy families. Now, this was the idea behind Kentucky's EOA bill a couple of years ago, the Education Opportunity Account bill, which did the same thing at the state level. It's where donors could have donated to a fund, and that fund would have created scholarships, a limited number of scholarships to essentially needy families. Now, the state Supreme Court heard that bill, the public school establishment challenged it, and the court amazingly found that that was actually taking public resources away from public education, which was mind-boggling because the money had not yet gone to the state in any way. It was simply incentivizing the individuals and the generosity of individuals and businesses to give to that fund. And yet, in a 7-0 ruling, the court struck down EOAs. Now, of course, we are in the process of looking at amending the Constitution. That's what the court said needed to be done. It's illegal to do anything like that without amending the Constitution. Kentucky has something in the Constitution called a Blaine Amendment, which really was discriminatory against Catholics who wanted to start their own schools. But we're in the process of considering, and we anticipate an education freedom amendment to come up in the next legislative session. Greg, I want to talk about some of the objections that people have, that really the education establishment has against programs like this, EOAs and the ECCA. The first one is that private schools are not accountable. In fact, I just heard this at a forum again, in Louisville the other day, where many public school teachers came out in opposition to any kind of education freedom expansion here in Kentucky. But one of the things that they say is that, look, there's no accountability for private schools. How do you address that?
I reject that argument entirely because private schools are accountable to parents. And of course, most of these parents are taxpayers themselves, if not all of them. But private schools are accountable to their customers, if you will. If the private schools are not producing a good academic product, are not creating a safe, maintaining a safe environment for children, one that has a discipline in the school, and if the private schools are not respecting the family's faith and values, that family has a choice. If they have access to resources, they have a choice to go elsewhere. And so they're accountable in that sense. A poorly performing private school would actually close due to lack of customers. On the other hand, it's the public schools, the traditional public schools, that are not accountable. Every time we bring up the argument, and you can see this all over the country, particularly in our urban areas, but it's happening in rural and suburban communities too. Public schools are failing children academically. They're not meeting the children's needs. Many of them are not safe. And we find an increasing number, of course, that are forcing children to be indoctrinated with left-wing ideology against their family's will, against their family's wishes, and contrary to their values. And if parents don't have the resources in public schools to leave public school to seek an alternative, their child's not only getting a poor education and being failed by the system, they don't have the ability to make any changes because the public schools are guaranteed a revenue stream with almost no accountability. I look at Detroit public schools, Chicago public schools. By the way, the president of the Chicago Teachers Union was just revealed a couple of months ago, sends her own child to a private school and had difficulty explaining her, justifying her case for that or rationale for that. And so it all comes back to money and power. Public schools are not accountable. Private schools are accountable to their customers. They will not stay open if they are producing or if they fail to produce a quality product.
Yeah, that's a very, very good response. Another argument against expanding education freedom is that private schools teach questionable curriculum. Now, you just brought up that this is indeed happening in public schools, and this is becoming increasingly evident to all of us. But how do you address the argument that, well, the private schools are teaching things that are questionable?
Again, I reject that completely because private schools are going to respond to the wishes of their customers. The Educational Choice for Children Act, or ECCA, doesn't dictate what choices parents should make with the resources that they would have access to under this opportunity. It simply allows them the opportunity to choose a school that produces a high-quality academic product, is safe, and respects their family's faith and values. So nobody's being indoctrinated in private schools because if you don't like the curriculum, you simply leave. In the public schools, if you lack resources, and let's say, you know, you're a family, low-income family, you know, in Chicago, and the schools are putting out a terrible product, but they're also teaching your children things that conflict with your faith and values, you're stuck. You're trapped if you don't have resources to be able to choose something different. And so we reject the argument that somehow these, you know, ideologies are questionable. If anything, that's happening in the public schools, that's happening in an increasing manner because there is a deliberate attempt in this country to promote and advance a left-wing ideology in the public schools. And parents are waking up to this. Many of them, of course, were waking up to it or were made aware of it in the midst of the pandemic when they were finally seeing, had the ability to see what was being taught and what wasn't being taught. And, you know, why is their child being taught essentially, you know, to embrace the, you know, Marxist agenda, for example, and socialism, and not being taught basic math and English grammar and so forth?
How do you address the argument that school choice will destroy public education? In fact, that is one of the most repeated arguments that the KEA and public school establishment has promoted here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. If you expand school choice or education freedom, you're destroying public education.
The KEA and their allies are absolutely wrong. If you look at Florida, which has robust educational choice offerings, both charter schools and private school choice opportunities, there's actually research available. If you go to investineducation.org, our organization, or if you go to my former organization, federationforchildren.org, and look at the research from Florida alone, you see that actually it has, private school choice has had a positive effect on public school performance. And that is the result of the competition that private schools are offering to public schools, or they're posing that to public schools, as well as keeping those public schools accountable. If parents have choices, public schools have no alternative but to respond to that or close up shop. And frankly, we do think that public schools that are failing should be closed. They should be held accountable in some way, not to simply throw trillions of, you know, they were showered with trillions of dollars after COVID, but nobody who was showering them with all these funds was insisting on any new accountability measures in public schools. So Florida, Ohio, you look around the country, Wisconsin, which has the oldest voucher program in the country, the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program, you can see the research, the data shows that private school choice has had a positive effect actually on public schools. Parents are satisfied. there's much stronger academic outcomes as a result. And ultimately, that's the main objective is, of course, empowering parents to choose something that of better quality, respectful of their faith and values for their children.
At this public forum that I was in Louisville, attended the other day, the figure of $19,000 per student is spent on public education. That's the Jefferson County Public School System, the largest public school system in the Commonwealth. A lot of money is being poured in. And yet it was said, one of the school board members said, well, we're not getting enough for our students. We just need more. We're understaffed. We're underfunded. And it was brought up to him, well, how much is enough? Well, Greg, so here's my question to you. How much is enough per student?
You find that the amounts are even higher in places like Detroit or Newark, New Jersey, where they're spending north of $20,000 per child. And look at the results. It's shameful, and it's a tragedy what's happening there. And then their only argument is let's spend more money, throw more money at the problem. This has been going on for decades. The public schools have been failing, and yet people are shoveling more and more cash into those. Private schools, like we said, are far more accountable and educate children on average well below that cost. So when you ask how much is enough, of course, it depends on the cost of living in a particular market. It's going to cost more to attend private school in, let's say, the Bay Area of Northern California around San Francisco and Oakland because the cost of living is higher there than it would be in Louisville or Omaha or Indianapolis. But I think many private schools are, I certainly know this from the Catholic school experience and also talking with leaders around the country from Lutheran schools, Orthodox Jewish schools, non-denominational Christian schools, and even non-sectarian private schools, that many of them offer opportunities for $7,000, $8,000 per child for grade school, $10,000 perhaps for high school. And many of the scholarship amounts at the state level school choice programs offer scholarships that are in that neighborhood. And for some low-income families, maybe if the state scholarship doesn't cover 100% of the tuition and cost, it comes close to that. And then maybe the private school helps to make up the difference that's there.
Very good. Greg Brock, thank you so much for joining us on the Commonwealth Matters. Thank you for what you're doing at the federal level to expand education freedom. And for all the listeners, if you've enjoyed this program, please tell your friends about us. Encourage them to subscribe to the Commonwealth Matters. Thank you again for tuning into the Commonwealth Matters. God bless, and we'll see you next week.